Good morning, everyone, and welcome. And welcome on this beautiful summer's day. It's as if suddenly summer has come. Welcome to those here in church, and welcome to our community joining us via the web camera. You belong here for the next while. And to those who happen to listen in at a later date. We begin with our opening words. For the beauty of the earth, the spinning blue-green ball, yes, Gaia, mother of everything, we gently walk across your back to come together again in this place, to remember how we can live, to remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live, welcomes us. Our chalice lighting. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom. Now we're going to have our first hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth. Hymn number 21. Let us pray. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds, and whose breath gives life to the world, hear me. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty and make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made, and my ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise that I may understand the things you have taught my people. Let me learn the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. Help me remain calm and strong in the face of all that comes towards me. Help me to find compassion without empathy overwhelming me. I seek strength, not to be greater than my brother, but to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me always ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes, so that when life fades, and as the fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame or fear. Amen. That prayer is from the Sioux Indians, the Native American Indians. Now can we join together to say the words at the back of our hymn book? These words attempt to articulate the aims of our community. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we with each other and with God. Jennifer is our reader this morning.
Morning, everybody. We pride ourselves, quite rightly, I think, on being an inclusive church. We like to say, and I love to hear it said, that this church welcomes those of all faiths and those of none. The listener might well wonder why those of no faith should bother coming to church at all. The writer, Alain de Botton, claims to have the answer. His book, entitled Religion for Atheists, was published in 2012. I found and continue to find it very interesting, and I think it deserves a wide readership. Here is part of the first chapter, which is entitled Wisdom Without Doctrine. Attempting to prove the non-existence of God can be an entertaining activity for atheists. Tough-minded critics of religion have found much pleasure in laying bare the idiocy of believers in remorseless detail, finishing only when they felt they had shown up their enemies as thoroughgoing simpletons or maniacs. Though this exercise has its satisfactions, the real issue is not whether God exists or not, but where to take the argument once one decides that he evidently doesn't. The premise of this book is that it must be possible to remain a committed atheist and nevertheless find religions useful, interesting, and consoling, and be curious as to the possibilities of importing certain of their ideas and practices into the secular realm. One can be left cold by the doctrines of the Christian Trinity and the Buddhist Eightfold Path, and yet at the same time be interested in the ways in which religions deliver sermons, promote morality, engender a spirit of community, make use of art and architecture, inspire travels, train minds, and encourage gratitude at the beauty of spring. In a world beset by fundamentalists of both believing and secular varieties, it must be possible to balance a rejection of religious faith with a selective reverence for religious rituals and concepts. It is when we stop believing that religions have been handed down from above, or else that they are entirely daft, that matters become more interesting. We can then recognize that we invented religions to serve two central needs, which continue to this day, and which secular society has not been able to solve with any particular skill. First, the need to live together in communities in harmony, despite our deeply rooted selfish and violent impulses. And second, the need to cope with terrifying degrees of pain, which arise from our vulnerability to professional failure, to troubled relationships, to the death of loved ones, and to our own decay and demise. God may be dead, but the urgent issues which impelled us to make him up still stir and demand resolutions which do not go away when we have been nudged to perceive some scientific inaccuracies in the tale of the seven loaves and fishes. The error of modern atheism has been to overlook how many aspects of the faiths remain relevant, even after their central tenets have been dismissed. Once we cease to feel that we must either prostrate ourselves before them or denigrate them, we're free to discover religions as repositories of a myriad ingenious concepts with which we can try to assuage a few of the most persistent and unattended ills of secular life. Religions merit our attention for their sheer conceptual ambition, for changing the world in a way that few secular institutions ever have. They have managed to combine theories about ethics and metaphysics with a practical involvement in education, fashion, politics, travel, hostelry, initiation ceremonies, publishing, art and architecture, a range of interests which puts to shame the scope of the achievements of even the greatest and most influential secular movements and individuals in history. For those interested in the spread and impact of ideas, it is hard not to be mesmerized by examples of the most successful educational and intellectual movements the planet has ever witnessed. Alain de Botton.
As ever, we like to have our children's story. And the story this morning is an old familiar one, the tale of the sorcerer's apprentice. And we all probably had it in the Ladybird book at home. But it's really interesting because I think we can learn a lot from it. There was a sorcerer, a magician, and he had an apprentice. And the apprentice was gradually learning the art of magic from him. And one day the sorcerer had to go away into town on an errand, and he left his apprentice there with instructions that he was to wash the floors of their house. And the apprentice started to wash the floors, and then he began to think, why am I doing all this, hauling water from the well, heating it up, carrying it up the stairs, using the mop? I am an apprentice sorcerer. I should be able to get the magic to work for me and get it to magically clean the house. So he cast a spell, and lo and behold, the mop did. It began to work. The mop went out, managed to get the water from the well, heated it up, brought it upstairs, and started to wash the house. The problem was it didn't stop washing the house. It just kept going and repeating it and repeating it. And in desperation, the young man, because he couldn't remember how to stop the broom working, he chopped the broom up into several pieces. And each piece became a full broom, and each broom got another pail and began to bring more water in. And suddenly the whole house on one floor was awash with water. He was terrified of what to do. Now, lucky for him, the sorcerer came back, clapped his hands and said the magic word, and all the mayhem stopped. I think this, the apprentice was very lucky that the sorcerer arrived just in time and was able to cure the problem. But what if the sorcerer hadn't come back? Sometimes we think that there's always going to be someone just to save us in the nick of time. And we might learn to our cost that this may not necessarily be so. Now we're going to have our second hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 11, O God of Stars and Sunlight. Hymn number 11. For my reading, I have chosen a piece by the theologian Tony Jones, and it's called God in Wild Places. It says, the God of wild places offers peace. In a modern world that's frantic and busy, always connected and always on, finding peace is getting to be more difficult. To receive the peace offered by the God of wild places, we have to take a retrograde step to the old technologies. To canoe and paddle, hiking boots and walking stick, and maybe a fishing pole. We also have to remember that the peace we long for is within us, a spark of the divine that resides within each of us. To bring that spark to a flame can be done indoors, but I have found a lot more luck when I'm outdoors, and the wilder the place, the better. The God of wild places honors place. When we visit and revisit the old places that are special to us, experience of transcendence are waiting there for us. I've sung a hymn to my most special place, a few acres of northern forest sitting on the edge of a lake. Caretaking that land is a joy and a privilege. And it's become clear to me that doing so is part of my vocation, my calling from God. These trees and this creek are my congregation to pastor and shepherd, as a pastor and shepherd cares for the sheep. They were torn asunder by a tornado, as was I, and they have grown in scarred beauty, as I have. These days I'm jealous in maintaining these woods, guarding and protecting them, doing what I can to keep them healthy and safe, safeguarding their peace. The God of wild places gives us companions. We may be hurtling through space, but we're not alone. We are interdependent on the whole fabric of creation, woven together with beings, sentient and non-sentient, animate and inanimate. I've stopped looking up to the sky for help and instead lowered my eyes to the companions around me. My dogs have been my most sacred non-human companions. Seth talks to plants. No matter the species with which we commune, the key is keeping the whole web in view, seeing the forest and the trees, for God's love pulses through the entire web. Jones describes how taking risks also invites greater reliance on God. The God of wild places, he says, requires risk. We've done everything we can to mitigate risks to ourselves. And this is an admirable trait that has ensured the propagation of the species. On a neurological level, adventure facilitates deep learning. On a spiritual level, high-risk situations strip us bare and make us vulnerable. Attaining the next level of success requires taking a chance, climbing a bigger mountain, hiking a bit more challenging trail, riding a bigger wave. Modern life tends to inoculate us against these risks, but the God of wild places peels away that safety and brings us back in touch with who we are and who we are meant to be. Let us pray, and this prayer will be brought to an end by a time of silence. Lord, in a world that is always resounding with noisy, angry, and alarming voices, help me listen more intently and gratefully to the other voices speaking of things lovely and gentle and of good report. Because the great winds blow noisily does not mean that the whispering breezes are of small account. When in the morning such evil and mischief shout in my ears and from the echoing pages, may I not be deafened to the voices of the quiet world, the gentle world that's not reported, because it is so ordinary, so constant, and so happy. Are not countless parents sending their children to school with fond biddings? And not teachers speaking the truths with which will long outlive the sensation of the moment? Are not armies of good workers putting their hands to familiar jobs, often with a lilt of a happy tune on their lips? Are not doctors and nurses saying cheerful words to many who are sick? Is not the air full of unrecorded speech, of neighborly encouragement, exchange of innocent jests, assurance of loyal friendship, and the music of those who sing to themselves? I do not want to close my eyes to the grave matters and warnings of storms, but may we also catch and cherish the still small voices. And may my lips not be scanty of sweet words and words of strength and perhaps a little wisdom to speak to my companions and passers-by I meet on life's common road. We now have a time of silence, and Josh will bring it to an end by a piece of music. Imbolc Bealtaine, Lunasa, and Samhain were the ancient Celtic festivals, and these were dressed in Christian clothes and incorporated into the new Christian religion. So Imbolc became St. Bridget's Day, Bealtaine was dedicated to Mary, the mother of Jesus, Lunasa became Reek Sunday, and Samhain the Feast of All Souls and All Saints. In recent years, the festivals have become even more popular. The new popularity is for the original pagan forms of the celebrations. And this change, I think, can be attributed somewhat to the fall off in adherence to traditional Christian forms, and to the fact that the festivals, however they were celebrated in the midst of history, developed from observing the world of nature. And nature is intimately connected to our lived experiences and to the festivals, so they touch our souls. Like this morning, everyone is in good humor because of the sun is shining, and we all notice the beautiful, lovely new green leaves on the trees in the way in this morning. And that's because the sun is shining. Imbolc is enjoying a newfound popularity with the new February bank holiday. Samhain is almost as popular as Christmas now. Lunasa, I think, is for the hardy individuals who want to show off their fitness by climbing Kirkpatrick. And last Wednesday was Bealtaine, or the first day of summer. And I think maybe it's the least celebrated of the four festivals. How the festivals are celebrated is interesting. And even in a short span of time, you can see how they've changed. My childhood memory of May Day is of church processions. School was delayed and we processed round the church and up the road a bit. A generation earlier, my elderly aunt recalled dancing around the maypole on May Day. Maypoles have largely disappeared by my time. How festivals are celebrated changes in even relatively short periods of time. So all we can do is make an educated guess at exactly how the pre-Christians celebrated any of these festivals. But that doesn't really mean that we shouldn't celebrate them, because when we are celebrating them, we're tailoring them not to what the pre-Christians needed, but to what we need and what speaks to us. The Irish translation of the word Bealtaine gives us a hint of the form of the festival. Bealtaine comes from Béilne Tine, which means mouth of the fire. So Bealtaine marked the end of winter and welcomed in summer. It was a declaration, winter is over. In many parts of the country, there's still a tradition of driving cattle between two smoking bonfires. And this was done when the cattle were going out to summer pastures. Another tradition was that hearth fires were extinguished and relit from a communal fire. And that was a visual representation of the Irish proverb, Arscoa Céile a Bhuirne Daoine, which roughly means, together we thrive and survive. We depend on one another. We work best when we're in community. And usually these celebrations would have involved bonfires, some drinking, sports competitions, singing and dancing, and making offering to the gods. It's interesting how Celtic spirituality is also enjoying a real revival. And I think that may be explained by the fact that the religious traditions that survive even now in Ireland are very ancient. Because Irish Christianity was different from the Christianity of the Roman Church. The Irish Christian Church remained independent from Rome until the 12th century. The English Church submitted to Rome 500 years earlier, and submitting to Rome meant that you accepted a common liturgy and common ways of doing things. We had our independent ways of doing it until the 12th century. And it was this independent form of Christianity that brought Irish monks to many parts of Europe. It was this independent Christianity that was not based on power. It had nothing to do with empires. It was based on the gospel, and it was rooted in the world of nature. Irish Christianity was not centered on bishops and cathedrals, but in monasteries. And these monasteries were built in places of natural beauty. The Book of Kells is one of the most famous Christian books in the world. It's a copy of the four Gospels, the original text of the Christian faith. Not the commentaries, not the epistles written by later people, but by original concentrating on original Christianity. And the pages are beautifully decorated with flowers and animals. So it was this nature-rooted, authentic Christianity that made Ireland the land of saints and scholars. Was not the Roman Church type of religion. When the old festivals were Christianized, ancient customs were incorporated into the new order. So our customs that were incorporated into the new order only happened in the 12th century. And old traditions are more likely to survive in rural communities. I listened online to a piece by somebody from Wexford talking about Bealtaine traditions. And she said that right up into the 20th century, at Bealtaine, friars visited farms and blessed the water. This water was then sprinkled on the ground, and she said it was to protect the soil from the trans, T-R-A-N-S. She didn't explain what trans is, but it seems to be a parasite that attacked corn. But today there are no fires to bless the land, and we may smile at the idea of using blessed water to control pests, or even sneer at their superstitious natures. Older, simpler, most superstitious methods did, however, have some positive side effects. If you think of somebody having a fire to bless the water that was put on the land, that made this land sacred for the people. It encouraged a reverence for nature and the land and everything on it. It promoted gratitude. And it was a communal event, so it bonded people together and to the natural world in a very holistic way. And it encouraged community. Obviously, modern insecticides do a much more effective role in controlling trans and other pests. But chemical sprays don't differentiate between harmful pests and useful ones. They upset the balance in nature, one that has developed over thousands of years. And the consequences of this is that nature has become depleted of its biodiversity. You know, the blessed water wasn't going to kill off the other insects, any insects properly, but it wasn't going to destroy nature. We humans are the most adaptable and creative creatures on the planet. But our great feeling is that we do live in a state of hubris. We actually think that we control the natural world and that we should control the natural world. But we don't, and we shouldn't. Our mistaken sense of control means we no longer look to one another for support. We're all expected to look after our own patch. So many people live isolated from other people and from the natural world. And we all know that loneliness is the great epidemic of our time. And a very stark statistic, 52% of Americans say they feel lonely. And 57% of them eat all their meals alone. No wonder loneliness is so prevalent. As farmers put their trust in pesticide and artificial fertilizers, we put our trust in pharmaceuticals to heal the spirit, instead of looking to one another. One of the most beloved and famous of the Christian saints is Francis of Assisi. He is remembered for his love of nature and of every living creature, and that he was such a joyful person. He had a joyful nature. He wasn't a miserable old saint. The ancient faiths knew that there were many paths to enlightenment, not just one, there were many. And Francis found his path to enlightenment by immersing himself in the world of nature. He observed it, respected it, and found his joy in the natural world. He didn't try to mold it or control it like we do. Because we think of nature as a resource to be exploited, and in this way we are destroying our world. We are foolish enough to believe that we don't depend on nature, that the destruction of nature ultimately will mean our own destruction. It's not that long ago that scientists first began to warn us of global warming. And they said, you know, within 100 years, this is going to happen. So I certainly tended to put that it wasn't going to be my problem. And we ignored their warnings because it wasn't going to affect us. And suddenly now we find ourselves experiencing the effects of global warming. We are living through changed weather patterns. The prolonged rain and windy weather has flooded the land, is badly affected insect numbers. We know that harvests have been delayed in being planted. In the past few years, there has been effort made to plant flowers in strips for pollinators. And I have to say, last year, at the beginning of summer, I noticed a real increase in hoverflies and bees and wasps and so on. And I thought, you know, we're starting to get the idea we need to look after nature. And then July came, of course. This year, for the first time since he began keeping bees 15 years ago, when he opened the hives in June, He said, this is going to be a bumper crop this year. It was full, they were full of honey. And then the rains came. And of course the bees couldn't get out to work. And the effect on the bees has been absolutely horrendous. And this has really brought it home to me. Last year, Paul had four different lots of bees in four locations. There were 10 hives in all. This year, and each hive, last year, our honey harvest in 2022, we got 234 jars of honey. Ergo then, we used to bring honey in to sell here at Christmas and cake sales and all of that. Last year, we got 31 jars of honey from all the hives. We did look after the bees. We did leave them honey for the winter. But of the 10 hives, only 2 have survived the winter. So it's an 80% mortality rate. And it's not that there's less bees in the hives. They have died out. And one of those hives was very special because it was a feral hive that he got. And we know that this hive had survived for 40 years in the wild. And then the building was being sold, so we took the bees out of it. But it was an Irish bee in this colony. And we know it was Irish bee because we did have it DNA tested. And it had terrific Irish DNA. Those bees were designed to survive Irish winters. They did not survive last year. And every hive, empty of bees, still had food in it. It wasn't that they starved to death. It was just that they were so unable to fly. They were unable to reproduce. They just died out and became disease prone. Just now, our apple tree is in bloom. And the blossoms have lingered longer than usual this year. The reason they linger is because when a blossom is fertilized, it falls off the tree, it's done its job, it doesn't need to do anything else, and it just disappears. So when we had bees, blossom time with any plant was much shorter than usual. But there are so few pollinators in our garden that our tree is still waiting for pollinators to come. One of the lovely things I enjoyed about gardening is in the summer just to sit in the garden and listen to the buzz of insects. For me, that was the song of summer. There are no insects. I can bemoan the fact that I'm deprived of one of my favourite sounds. But what pollinators are there to pollinate crops? What are swallows going to feed their young with if they arrive from Africa? And this is climate change in action. And it is the result of human activity. So it's beyond time for us to live by those old mantras: reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce our footprint. Be stingy with the amount of carbon you use. Don't put on the heat. Wrap up in a blanket if you're just sitting there. Another thing we can refrain from doing is don't put lighting in your garden because insects need to go to sleep at night. Some come out, but some like to sleep at night. Tread lightly on the earth. Don't leave your electrical things on standby. They're using up power. Leave your car behind, not every time, but some of the time. One of the things we noticed, it was Tony Brady who told me that just turn off everything that you have on standby. And we started doing that, and I found it awkward for a few days. Now it's part of just normal behavior. But we got our electricity bill, and it told us we had used 32 less units of electricity over 2 months. Now, that is not going to save the world. But if you multiply that by 6 electricity bills in the year, and then by about 3 million for the 3 million homes in Ireland, it will make a difference. And it doesn't cost us anything. Nurture the world of nature, even if it's a few plants on the balcony, and spend time in nature. That is one of the great restoring powers for the human soul. And listen to whatever song of summer you manage to tune into. Amen. We're now going to have our third hymn, and it's hymn number 76, For Flowers That Bloom About Our Feet. Hymn number 76. Notices. Tea and coffee served downstairs after the service. Everyone is welcome to join us. There's some copies of Oscult magazine on the table outside for the month of May. And Wednesday at lunchtime, service of reflection from the church available in the church and on the web camera. And next Sunday after the service, there's going to be some bedding plants for sale. The usual ones, dahlias and asters and marigolds and all those ones, and there are some tomato plants as well for those interested in having some nice tomatoes, and funds will be in aid of the Cork Church. And there's a walk on Saturday the 18th May. The meetup point is Seed Cafe, and it's down at it's along the banks of the Avondale River, and it's the Seed Cafe. They're meeting at 11, begin to walk at 11:30. There's a book club meeting on the last Wednesday of the month, which is the 28th of May, and it happens in church, in the vestry, and live on Zoom. And just to say again that last week I had a phone call from a lady called Liz, who is looking for a bit of financial help. She is moving into third year studying addiction, and she is a mature student, but she's not entitled to grants from the government because she's in a private college. But she's very determined. She's going to finish her degree, and if anyone could help with her fees, she'd be grateful. She doesn't want people to pay all her fees for her, but some modules are €300, some are €600, if anyone wanted to give her something towards that. Now we have our final hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 207, Earth Was Given as a Garden. Hymn number 207. Beauty is before me and beauty is behind me. Above me and below me hovers the beautiful. I'm surrounded by it and immersed in it. In my youth, I'm aware of it, and in old age, I shall walk gently the beautiful trail. In beauty, it began, and in beauty, it will end. Amen.